Welcome to episode 184 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real, who matters, and how we can make a better world. The Sentientism worldview answers those deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. This episode is a bonus cross-post of my discussion with Ariel Pontes. His Ghostless Machine podcast includes a series of dialogues where he has friendly disagreements over controversial topics with a variety of guests. I had the pleasure of being his first. Make sure you go and subscribe. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I did talking to Ariel. Feedback and suggestions are always welcome. As ever, I'm only one sentientist, so others will disagree. I also wanted to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's recently joined one of our online communities. More people join us there every day, whether they think of themselves as sentientists or not. The groups are open to everyone interested. Just search for the word sentientism, that's sentient with ism on the end, on your favourite platforms. Facebook is our biggest at the moment, and you'll find us there. Thanks for listening.
Do you think of veganism as a moral baseline? This is an idea that I hear a lot.
Yeah, I do. And it's probably worth explaining to your audience what I think veganism is. So in simple terms, I think veganism is a philosophical stance and a practical set of decisions that's trying to avoid causing suffering, exploitation, and death.
Hi, this is Ariel Pontes. Welcome to the Ghostless Machine podcast. I have a background in computer engineering and analytic philosophy, and I've been blogging on and off about science, philosophy, and rationality for over a decade now. I usually use this space only to make my blog posts available in audio format, but today is a special day because I have my first guest, and hopefully not the last. So let me give you a quick summary of my future plans for this podcast. So, anybody who's familiar with my content at all knows that I've been quite concerned about political polarization for a while. My goal with this episode is to start a series of friendly conversations on controversial topics. My hope is that this will contribute to creating a culture with more dialogue and less polarization, more restorative justice and less cancel culture, and more moderation and less extremism in general. In order to achieve this, I will try to ground my conversations on three core values: scout mindset, nonviolent communication, and radical honesty. If you think this is a valuable project, please talk about it with your friends, follow me on social media, share your feedback, and consider making a donation. You can find all the relevant links at ghostlessmachine.com. My first guest in this new experiment will be Jamie Woodhouse. Jamie runs a community that he calls Sentientism. He has a website, a podcast, and a Facebook group, all of which are linked in the description. For those who don't know, sentience is the capacity of an entity to experience valenced states of consciousness, or in other words, the capacity to experience subjective states with a negative or positive character. Jamie tends to see veganism as a moral baseline, as basically the least you can do if you want to call yourself a sentientist. I have a more reducitarian approach, and although I agree that some actions are objectively better than others, I don't think there is such a thing as objectively permissible or impermissible actions. So, is veganism a moral obligation? Hi, so I'm here with Jamie Woodhouse. Thanks for being my first guest, Jamie.
Thank you. It's a real honor to be your first guest, hopefully first of many.
Yeah, thank you so much. We can start by, you can start by introducing yourself quickly.
Yeah, so this brief introduction, my name's Jamie Woodhouse, and my main personal project is to develop and popularize a really simple pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which I think is going to be very relevant to our conversation today. And in a sentence, it's a commitment to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. So if you like, it's a combination of a naturalistic way of understanding the world using evidence and reason, and a commitment to having compassion for every sentient being, any being that can experience things, that can suffer, can flourish. So that's what I'm about. Cool.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks. So, yeah, I mean, as I mentioned to you before, I have a list of questions that I prepared as sort of as a script that I plan to use for this conversation and for future ones as well. But we don't have to stick to it too rigidly. I want it to be like informal, and I want it to flow naturally. So, yeah, but let me start with the first question. I'm curious to hear, what do you think you and I have in common?
Well, we don't know each other very well, although it's been brilliant to have you as a contributor to some of our sentientism online forums, our Facebook in particular. I've read some of your writing and enjoyed our online conversation. So it's great to have a proper conversation, although not quite in real life. But I think the things we probably have in common, I think we do share a naturalistic commitment to understanding the world, you know, something that's grounded in evidence and reason, broadly defined sort of scientific way of understanding the world that has, I guess, humility and doubt at its center, always being open-minded, always being ready to take on new evidence, even if it's uncomfortable, always being aware of our own biases, flaws in our own thinking, never thinking we can get things perfectly right, but always being trying to look for better evidence and look for better ways of thinking to try and understand the world in a humble way. So I think we probably share that epistemological stance pretty strongly.
Definitely.
I think when we come on to the other big question of philosophy, the question of ethics, I think I might take a more pluralistic approach than you do, since you might have a more utilitarian focus, and I have a great appreciation for that. But I've, over time, as I've thought amateurishly about these topics, come to appreciate maybe a more pluralistic, mixed approach to ethics. But I think another interesting point of commonality is that I think, at least in theory, we do share this sentiocentric compassion. We do, I think, recognize that sentience, the capacity to have experiences, the capacity to suffer, for example, is what's relevant to the moral consideration of others and to us having compassion for others and how that links into ethics. So I think we probably share that stance in theory. I think probably our main difference is about the level of demandingness about how we put that into practice and what some of the trade-offs might be about, you know, how we apply that into our personal lives in a practical sense. So I think this, we have quite a lot in common, but I'm sure we still have some interesting disagreements too. I don't know whether you'd agree with that characterization, if I've got it right.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, pretty close to what I would say as well. I mean, I also don't know you so well, but from what I've seen, we seem to agree on the naturalistic approach. I mean, we both have been roaming in similar circles to some degree, at least online, or, you know, like similar intellectual circles with secular humanism, atheist bloggers, things like that. And yeah, the part about sentience, for sure, you've been involved for way longer than me, and it's a way more important cause for you. You can see that. But I think also at a philosophical level, we do tend to agree largely. And that's why one of the reasons why I chose you as my first guest, because since this is a new experiment for me, I think it wouldn't be too hard. Our disagreements are quite nuanced, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it'll be interesting to find out. Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, again, just another comment about the format. I will basically have these questions and I will ask you and I will probably also answer myself. And yeah, it's you started well going the direction, what we have in common and what we might disagree on. That would be my next question. Like, how can we make our disagreement as clear as possible? So where do you think that we disagree? And then I can tell you also where do I think we disagree.
Well, given the topic of this episode, and I think the way you're going to title it, I think it does center on these the practical implications of sentiocentrism, if you like, and zeroing in even more further, even more closely, disagreements about veganism and whether it's a moral obligation. So personally, I think veganism is a direct implication of taking a sentiocentric stance to moral consideration. And actually, I don't think veganism goes far enough. I think veganism is actually quite limited when you compare it to a broader set of obligations that might flow out of a sentientist way of thinking. Whereas I think your sense is that you can have a sentiocentric moral scope in theory, but it's still allowable to not be vegan in terms of, you know, the boycott of products that are made through the suffering and death of sentient beings. And I think you found a way to allow that that I don't think works. So I don't, again, I'd be interested in your view as to whether that's the difference. I think there's maybe also a difference in that sometimes I think you talk about priorities and choosing different priorities. And we may well disagree about different priorities, but I think our disagreement isn't about cause priorities. It's about a moral baseline for our own personal choices, which can be somewhat independent of the causes we choose to engage in, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think a good question to ask would be: do you agree that veganism is a moral obligation, or at least we should all at least be vegan? As you mentioned, we should be probably even more than that. And I'm also curious to hear what you mean. But do you think that veganism as a moral? Do you think of veganism as a moral baseline? This is an idea that I hear a lot.
Yeah, I do, and it's probably worth explaining to your audience what I think veganism is. So. In simple terms, I think veganism is a philosophical stance and a practical set of decisions that's trying to avoid causing suffering, exploitation, and death to other sentient beings. And although the definition of veganism uses the term animal, which is a pretty good shortcut for sentient beings, although it's not an exact fit. So in that sense, it's an aspiration to try to avoid causing exploitation, suffering, and death to animals. And I do think trying to avoid causing those things is a moral obligation. I think if anything's a moral obligation, then that should be. I think it's interesting to consider that even the definition of veganism does include terms like where possible and where practical, to recognize that this isn't about some sort of complete ethical purity stance with no exceptions. There may well be situations where things are extremely difficult and we have to take very hard moral decisions where there is no obvious right answer, and where harm, exploitation, and suffering, and death might be something we just have to cause. So just as within a humanist ethic, that doesn't mean there's no situation where you could justify harming a human or even killing a human. There may well be situations, tough situations, where those things are justified. I think veganism leaves that door open too, with this sort of sense of what's practical and possible. But the core of it is this aspiration to avoid causing suffering, exploitation, and death. And I think that's almost as close to a sort of tautological definition of a moral obligation as anything, once you've agreed that it's not just humans that matter. So I think if you were to say, well, you know, if you took an anthropocentric version of veganism, what would that be? It would essentially be a stance that says, I'm going to do what I can where practicable and possible to avoid causing the suffering, exploitation, and killing of other humans. And I think for a humanist, that would be pretty hard to object to as a start. It's almost definitionally the core of what it means to have moral consideration for other humans. And in a way, veganism is taking exactly that stance and saying, if we care about animals, or in my terms, sentient beings, that's the minimum requirement, that we would try at least to avoid causing their suffering, exploitation, and death where we can.
Yeah, I think that what might be the disagreement there, well, I guess we can get pretty quickly into this difficult philosophical problems like the existence of moral obligations. So do you think there's such a thing as objective moral obligation? I mean, things that, let's say two people disagree. One think, yeah, this is an obligation. And another says, no, this is not. Do you think there is an objective answer to that question, or is it ultimately cultural, subjective, etc.?
Yeah. So one disclaimer is I'm not a philosopher. I've read a lot of philosophy and I love talking to philosophers, and I've had many philosophers as my guests, but I'm not a philosopher. So my terminology often gets a little bit fuzzy, and I may be inaccurate in the way I describe these things. But part of the reason I'm a bit fuzzy about these terms is because sometimes I'm not sure they're enormously useful. And what I try to focus on in the sentientism idea is remaining philosophically pluralistic, so quite open to all sorts of different philosophical stances, but to be very clear about what the baseline is. So what I'm most interested in with sentientism is explaining the scope of our moral consideration, who gets to count in our moral consideration. And there's different ways of explaining that. You can talk about moral consideration, you can talk about moral status, you can talk about subjects of care, you can talk about beings being ends in themselves. You can talk about them being subjects of compassion. Yeah. So in a way, that's the way I describe sentientism as being, it's about compassion for all sentient beings. And there are many different ways of putting that into practice, depending on what sort of ethical system you apply. To my mind, a moral obligation really is just something we should do in the context of our moral system. So to answer your question personally, and this is one of the fascinating things about sentientism, is you'll find moral realists, moral anti-realists, mm-hmm. you'll find feminist care ethics people, utilitarians, consequentialists, deontologists, virtue ethicists, you know, the full swathe of people mm-hmm. who all have very different ways of expressing compassion mm-hmm. to sentient beings. And to be honest, I've struggled to work out where I sit on the question mm-hmm. you answered. So let me put it a few different ways. One, I'm not a relativist. So mm-hmm. to my mind, I think it's extremely dangerous to think in a relativistic way that says just because a group of humans have agreed on a moral stance that is, in essence, well-founded, regardless of the suffering or death it causes. I think that's bizarre, somewhat arbitrary, and can trap us into very awful situations where needless harm is caused to very many people within and outside of the group. So I'm absolutely not a relativist. At the same time, I'm not a moral realist in the sort of purely Platonic sense where I think that moral rights and wrongs or moral truths existed before sentient beings existed, you know, so mm-hmm. before the Precambrian when there were no sentient beings at all. I just don't think there was such a thing as morality at all, because mm-hmm. I think morality only That's makes sense in the context of there being sentient beings that can experience harm and flourishing. So in that sense, I'm certainly not a relativist. So I'm not a, you know, extreme anti-realist, but I'm also not a realist in that sense. So, but the sense in which I think I am a realist is that I think sentient beings exist. They're real objective things that have subjective perspectives. And my casting of morality is that it's a decision about whether and how to care about the experiences of those other sentient beings. Those sentient beings generally don't like suffering. It's in the definition of the word, and they generally want to keep living. So my morality is a choice to care about that in other sentient beings. So in that sense, it is realist because it's grounded in the experience and the will to live of other sentient beings, which are real, absolutely real phenomena. Does that make sense? So I don't know whether you'd call me a realist or an anti-realist or whatever else, but I'm sort of, that's where I sit personally.
Yeah, no, you seem to be leaning to some sort of realism, perhaps slightly more than me. And I mean, it's tricky because I also can't really situate myself either. And I mean, just to address something you said earlier in your answer about not being a philosopher, actually, that's one of the things that I want to promote with this podcast, is that everybody is a philosopher at the end of the day. Yeah. I mean, sure, I also don't present myself as a philosopher. I mean, I studied computer engineering and my bachelor's is not really related. I did a master's in philosophy, but you know, that's limited compared to a lot of other people. But at the end of the day, we are all interested in these topics, trying to find answers to moral questions. And this is philosophy, ultimately. And I mean, in terms of where I situate myself, I'm also definitely not a relativist. And I am a realist in the sense that I do believe that there are certain things are objectively better than others. So I would say, yeah, like to burn a person to death is worse than, I don't know, shoot them quickly, give them, or just kill them very quickly or when they're asleep. So this is something that I consider an objective truth. But so when it comes to the good, I do believe that, yeah, as you mentioned, I lean more towards utilitarianism. I don't like to embrace this label because I think even the very fact that we label these moral theories creates a rigidity that I don't really like. I mean, it creates tribes of people who I know, I will defend this moral theory, I will defend this other moral theory. And often I feel that moral philosophy is a lot about basically different languages. Like each moral theory is a development of a language and a direction. Okay, let's try this way of talking about things and see where we get. And sometimes it can be helpful. So I think there are aspects of the ontology that can be helpful. There are, for example, how the focus on rules, on figuring out rules. I think this has a place in utilitarianism as well, in some versions of it. But yes, is considered widely to be a deontological approach. Of virtue ethics also, there are many interesting insights there. But yeah, ultimately, I think in terms of the meaning of the words, right, if good means anything, if bad means anything, it has to be related with the experience of sentient beings. So this is where I think we agree. Where I think we disagree is on this sort of what I see as a sort of black and white a sharp boundary between right and wrong. Like as a consequentialist, you know, I see the right as basically the maximization of the good. So this is for me quite straightforward. But for other people, if you have a more deontological approach, then you think, no, at some points, maximizing the good is not good enough, or it's not even, or it's actually bad. It can be even, it can become wrong, not bad, but wrong. And this is where I think we might disagree. There is an analogy that I like to make, and I wonder what you think about it. Basically, I would agree with you that, you know, it's lunchtime, you're hungry, and you go to a restaurant and you can order the vegan dish or the steak. I agree that it's objectively, I will go that far, and many of my non-vegan friends will get very triggered, or at least acquaintances, by this. But I agree that it's the better decision morally is to eat the vegan meal. But I don't think there is a black and white, okay, how, at what point does it become an obligation, and at what point does it become like an option? I think this is fundamentally subjective and culturally relative. So, for example, I agree, and I suppose that you also agree that some people are objectively taller than others. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, yeah. I'll go along with that. Yeah.
Yeah, but would you say when we're not comparing things, when we're just saying, okay, I met this person and they're really tall. I met a very tall guy at work. And then maybe I talk about this colleague, and when you meet him, you say, "Ah, he's not that tall. I mean, I wouldn't say he's a tall guy. I mean, he's not short, but I wouldn't say he's tall." And then we have this disagreement. You know, how do we resolve this disagreement? Do you think there is an objective solution to this disagreement?
You can agree on, you know, common standards you might agree on, and you might find objective measurement methods to compare. There's always going to be some degree of semantics involved. Mm-hmm. So I guess you could find a way to, you know, if not resolve the difference, at least clarify it there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most obvious way to define, right, as we do it like in medicine, or for example, I don't know, age of majority, like when you can actually do things, it's when is a person mature enough? You know, there's a lot of disagreement. So basically our solution, our pragmatic solution to these problems, at least at the level of policy, is usually to just stipulate a convention. Just, okay, let's just agree on 18 is good enough. And we agree that, okay, if you're 18, you're mature enough to act as an adult. Mm-hmm. And in a similar way, you could medically define arbitrarily, okay, if you're more than 180, you're tall. Or if you're, you know, this much above average, or if you're in I don't know which percentile of the distribution. But this is arbitrary. And in the same way, I think the definition of, okay, sure, the more vegan you are, the better. But when does it become 100%? Or, you know, like, as some people mentioned, like, you still are causing harm to animals to some degree, even by eating vegetables, because, you know, there are pesticides that are used, they're killing the rodents. So if you could only, if, you know, it would be better if you only ate from your own garden, where you know you're not killing the animals and all that. But it becomes so impracticable that people agree that, okay, this is not really a requirement. This is really not really an obligation. It's okay to eat food from the supermarket as long as it's vegan. And this is what I think is arbitrary. And then because I think it's arbitrary, my approach as somebody who's very consequentialist would be that, okay, what should we promote? You know, basically the idea to me of what is a moral obligation or not is an empirical question. So is it a moral obligation, for example, to help someone who's dying on the streets? If you're a driver and you pass by an accident, in most countries, there is legislation that like forces you to, like, you have to assist. And if you don't, it's like negligence and it's some type of criminal behavior. And so in an empirical sense, I would say, yes, in this society, it is a moral obligation to help people who need assistance in certain situations. But it's just an observation. It's not a moral claim. So in that sense, I would say that in our society, it's simply not empirically true that being veganism is a moral obligation. I mean, I can go eat meat on the streets all the time. It's very easy, actually way harder to be vegan. It's easier to eat meat all the time and you get away with it. People don't really stop. Maybe, you know, in some countries you'll get a group of vegan activists screaming at you at the restaurant. But that's going to be happen like once in your life. And it's very rare type of thing. You can just shrug it off and go on with your life. This is kind of where I situate myself. I mean, before we go even deeper into these questions, I'm curious, how confident would you say you are that no, there really is an obligation in terms of, there really is a split between what's permissible and not permissible. How confident would you say you are in that?
Well, I don't think I'm enormously confident because I'm quite sympathetic to the way you framed, you know, the complexity of moral choices. You know, you have the omission and the commission. You know, is it worse to cause harm than to avoid harm? Do we have an obligation to avoid harming? Do we have an obligation to help? You know, these are really rich and complex questions. And I don't agree with sort of really strict, clear, pure binaries. So people who claim that being vegan is 100% ethically pure and you have no more work to do is patently ridiculous. So I'm not a fan of drawing, you know, really crisp, pure dividing lines, because I think the position of those dividing lines, you're right to a degree, can be arbitrary. But because they're arbitrary doesn't mean they're meaningless, and it doesn't mean they're on a spectrum that has no value. And one of the dangers in rejecting the sort of binary purity is that you refuse to draw lines anywhere at all. And if you refuse to draw lines anywhere at all in terms of your personal choices or our systemic choices, you've abandoned ethics and morality completely. So on the one hand, I'm sympathetic with this idea of drawing, you know, really crisp, clear lines, and on one side is zero, the other side is 100%. Of course, right? That doesn't make sense. But I'm also very nervous that the flexibility we might adopt leads us to back away from ethical questions completely. Mm-hmm. So the balance, I guess, I've found is to think, again, going back to this sentientist stance of saying, well, if we're going to have compassion for all sentient beings, whatever ethical system we use, what's the minimum protection that you or I would expect? If someone said to you, I have compassion for you, you have moral standing and status, I care about you, you know, you're a moral patient in your own right. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, what's the minimum protection I'd require, I'd expect from that status, so even a minimal level? You know, I might want to be helped if I need help. And maybe even that is too much to ask. You know, it's a big world. It's a complex universe. There are 8 billion humans. There are however many quadrillion sentient beings. Maybe an obligation to help is just too tough. But at the absolute minimum, I think I would expect not to be needlessly harmed or killed, right? That's the absolute basic minimum. For the words compassion, care, moral consideration, and moral patience to mean anything at all. So in a way, that's the way I tend to think of these things practically, is that, of course, there might be exceptions and there are always difficult situations and there's no purity here. But if I can choose not to cause harm or exploitation and death, and in my situation, you know, maybe I have the privilege and the luck to be able to make that choice all the time pretty easily, then, yeah, I should do that. And I think it's quite interesting to take the way people think about non-human animal ethics and ask whether that approach would actually work in their intra-human ethics too. And I think often it doesn't. So if you take this stance of saying, well, you know, almost every way of living causes some harm to non-human animals, so there's no perfect line we can draw. So it's acceptable for me to continue, even if I don't need to continue consuming some animal products because there's no purity. There's always going to be some harm. So I'm just going to draw the line in a different place. I think if you apply that to many intra-human ethical situations, you'd bump up against some pretty strong social and intuitional norms. So if someone said, you know, it's impossible to cause to live a life without causing some form of exploitation to other humans, you know, there are exploitation in supply chains, there may be misintended consequences, there may be, you know, accidental deaths in certain industries based to create the products I make. So because there's always going to be some harm, I can't be ethically perfect. And because the drawing of lines is somewhat arbitrary, and because it's convenient for me, I will quite happily procure products that I don't necessarily need, that I know were made through modern enslavement. And I'm going to do that because I'm just drawing the line in a slightly different place. Or if you want to get even more extreme, you could even argue that it would be okay to purchase products that explicitly were produced through the suffering and death of other humans, right? If you can imagine a human steak on the shelf in the supermarket, I can imagine someone saying to me, if they'd grown up in that society where this was normal, they might well say a similar thing. They would say, well, we always cause some harm. The drawing of these lines is somewhat arbitrary. It's difficult in my society because it's quite normal to order, you know, human steak in the supermarket. Yeah. So I'm going to do that. You know, maybe I'll go meatless Mondays, you know, as a way of cutting down. But I'm just drawing the line at a different place. And I think it's quite interesting to contrast the way we think about non-human animals and the way we think about human animals, because often, unfortunately, we've been trained and indoctrinated to apply a very different ethical system between those two fields of moral patience. So.
Yeah, don't you think it makes sense, though, like considering like evolutionarily how we evolved and we are omnivores, like the more variety of food that we can eat, the better, it's rare. I mean, we didn't evolve as herbivores. So, I mean, of course, it's natural that our brains evolved to be somewhat psychopathic when it comes to animals. Like, we have this very weird relationship to them. Like, we like cats and we take care of the cats and we get attached to them. But then we see the cat killing a bird. Like, if we play with a bird, we won't play to kill the bird. At least maybe if you're a child and not very... Yeah. Yeah, usually we won't do these things. And also when we watch wildlife documentaries, you know, if it's from the side of the lion, somehow we're rooting for the lion. If they're saying, they need food or else the pups are going to die. But then also if it's a documentary about zebras, then we're going to be like, poor zebra, you're rooting for zebra.
But that's an excuse, not a reason, right? That's a description of how we've come to think, not a norm that we should think. And I think, again, it's interesting because
it has implications.
It does have implications descriptively for how we think, right? But we have the same method within intrahuman ethics too, right? So we have evolved to be tribal and to be politicized and to, you know, focus on the in-group and to denigrate and maybe even be aggressive to the out-group. But we've come to recognize that those aren't good things, right, in modern humanistic ethics.
Yeah, but and we still tolerate them to some degree, right?
And should we, right? You know, I mean, if someone was to say, look, it's natural for me to be racist because those people look different from me and they're a different group and I don't know them and their customs are a bit, you know, unfamiliar, would you say, yeah, that's absolutely fine. You know, this is a natural thing. This is how you've evolved.
Actually, you'd be surprised because, I mean, I wouldn't say that it's, sure, it's fine and no problem. Yeah. But I do think, you know, recognizing their experience is important. And I do think that in the anti-racist circles, this is not really happening. I mean, they're just portrayed as like total insane people. And like, this is an experience. I mean, we do tolerate the tribal behavior in many situations, like sports, for example, or music genres. And there are all sorts of, we're trying to learn how to manipulate ourselves into, okay, let's, you know, use these instincts and let's kind of steer things in a way so that, you know, we learn to cope with them in a healthier way. So instead of, you know,
of course.
Killing the other tribe, we go to a football match.
Of course. Right. So I think it's really important to, with an open mind, understand why human minds have come to think in certain ways completely. So the sociology and psychology of racism and sexism and transphobia and, you know, and speciesism are all absolutely fascinating and deeply important. We need to look at them with clear eyes. And And one implication of a sentientist compassion for all sentient beings is that we also have to have compassion for the people we disagree with too, even if we're arguing with them on Twitter, or even if they have deeply objectionable views, or even if they cause harm, right? So I'm with you on that as an understanding, but again, that's not a moral justification. And I agree, we've got to find ways of sort of hacking our human psychology because it's evolved in a certain way. So we've got to work with it, right? We can't just wipe the slate clean. But the way we do that with football matches or music or other, you know, groupish affiliations is we do that in ways that try to avoid causing harm because we know that needlessly causing harm is bad. And I'm suggesting we could do similar things in, you know, in a sentientist sense. And it's interesting because, you know, there is a natural history there about how we think of non-human animals and non-human sentience. But it's not all bad either because, you know, there's a puppy at my feet here. You know, they're a charismatic wildlife. I think it's also a very deep part of the human psyche to intuitively and directly accord moral patience to non-human sentient beings and to care about their suffering. And interestingly, you see that in the field of sci-fi, I think is another really interesting thought experiment where the authors and the readers and the people who watch the films intuitively and directly and genuinely feel compassion, not just for non-human animals that are sentient, but for completely alien species or completely artificial species that are sentient. And it's a very natural thing for us to do. So on the one hand, I think you're right. You know, there are some parts of the human psyche that lead us to think in very brutal ways about non-human sentient. But we also have this deep capacity to care about suffering regardless of who is suffering and regardless of their substrate or their species or their race or their gender or their sexuality. So there's, as ever with human psychology, there's good and bad to work on. But I do want to draw a clear line between a descriptive understanding that can be helpful of how we've come to think and a more normative stance that recognizes that needlessly causing suffering and death is just a bad thing, because that's what morality is.
Yeah, this is I think it's an interesting direction to go, because I hear this a lot from vegans. And in the beginning, I used to say I agree, but then I don't know if I would say I agree now. Basically, if I go back to the three ends, right, of carnism, right, there's this author.
Melanie Joy.
What's that? Melanie Joy, yes. She has this concept that I find interesting, that eating meat, people who just in order to justify in a carnistic culture, they would say that there is natural, normal, and
necessary.
Natural, normal and necessary, yeah.
And sometimes nice and, as well.
Yeah. So the normal and necessary, I agree that it's not true. I mean, normal. Well, it's common. So in that sense, it's true. But natural, in the sense of... there's a lot of debate about how natural it is that we eat meat, how easy it would be for the whole population to go vegan, if it's necessary. These are all not really black and white questions. And often when I discuss with non-vegans, they put too much emphasis on that and I get annoyed. And because of that, I started saying, you know what? It doesn't matter. Like so what if it's natural? It still means that we should still reduce. It's still suffering. But now I started seeing also how vegans go a bit to the other extreme sometimes, and they will say, no, it's completely irrelevant whether it's natural or not. And I don't think that's the case. And I don't think that's the case in a very pragmatic sense. Like, if it's true that we have a natural predisposition to eat meat so that a big portion of the population will struggle psychologically a lot to give up meat because simply like there isn't a biological component to their meat cravings and all that. If this is true, this would have implications to how we approach this whole debate. If our ultimate goal is to reduce animal suffering as much as possible, as fast as possible. And I think this is often neglected. Like, I really estimate that it's quite natural that a lot of people really crave meat and that there is a strong biological component for their meat craving. And I do think that's relevant, and not in a sense that it justifies eating meat without thinking about it. No, I don't agree with that. But it does justify us in the sense of maybe we don't have to set the baseline so in a way that's so demanding for so many people. Because people will just, it will backfire basically, and people will resist. So, yeah.
What do you think? I think there's a few separate things here. One is, if we're talking about, is it natural? You know, there's a real common problem that you'll be very familiar with, which is the naturalistic fallacy, which is often used in human ethics too, where people say, well, it's natural for us to conduct infanticide and to murder others and to conduct genocide. So, you know, it must be okay. And you and I both disagree with that, right? Something being natural is not an ethical justification in the human sphere or the intrahuman sphere. So I think what you mean when you're talking about natural, if you break it down a little bit further, is maybe a nutritional thing. You know, do we need meat to be healthy and thrive as humans? And there's also this psychological challenge too. Now, on the nutrition front, I'm not a nutritionist and people should take the right dietary advice, but my understanding of it, interestingly, is the same for humans but also for dogs and cats. I interviewed you know, the premier veterinary academic, Dr. Andrew Knight, recently about vegan pet foods. And what he said, I think, applies for humans just as it does to dogs and cats. So we might say, well, cats are carnivores and maybe humans and dogs are omnivores. Therefore, you know, we have to have some meat as part of their diets. And I think, firstly, the definition of an omnivore by definition means you can have a 100% plant-based diet. But two, those concepts are somewhat irrelevant because what animals need is specific nutrients, right? We don't need meat or dairy or eggs. We just need specific nutrients, or even at the more detailed level, certain chemical compounds to enable us to thrive. And as long as those nutrients are available in a plant-based diet, and it doesn't have to be well-planned, right? Just as an omnivore diet should be well-planned, then at the worst, a well-planned vegan diet is neutral compared to, you know, an average or even a well-planned omnivore diet. And there is some evidence that it can be better, but we should be very careful not to let sort of vegan wishful thinking or motivated reasoning drive us to overstate the benefits of a plant-based diet. But, you know, from my understanding of the science, I'm very confident that a well-planned vegan diet is at worst equivalent to an average omnivore diet, although it's a pretty low bar. So I don't think the nutrition thing is a challenge. But it can be practically, because that means you do have to be in a position where you can get access to the right sorts of foods and supplements and so on. So there's the nutrition thing. The psychology thing, again, I think isn't so much about, you know, whether a vegan world is what we should be aiming for, or whether we should be looking towards a world where we end the exploitation and farming of sentient animals and sentient beings. I don't think it changes that. But I think you're right that it does change the tactics we might approach the campaign with, because we have to have a realistic understanding of human psychology and sociology if we want to be productive. But I do think it's important to distinguish our tactics from our moral justifications for the end point, if that makes sense. So, so your human psychology might lead us to say we should use different tactics, but it doesn't change the outcome we should be aiming for, because too often the debates end up just talking about us humans, right? And humans are not the point of veganism, right? Veganism is a call for action to humans, but the point is about the non-human animal victims of the exploitation. And it's very easy to forget their perspective in these debates, and we end up thinking about different human psychologies and sociological structures and tactics. It's always important to come back to thinking about not just the, you know, billions and trillions of victims of these systems, but the actual individual victims and what their experiences are like. And I think that's the lodestone. Just as it is in human ethics, we need to think about the perspective of the other, understand how they feel and what they want and their wishes and desires and interests. And I think if we can do that when it comes to all sentient beings, that can, you know, draw us back in the conversation to, you know, what's the ethical core of what we're discussing here.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting how this conversation often gets. Yeah, so we were talking about strategy on the one hand, well, it's moral truth on the other hand, also goals. I agree with you that understanding reality impacts shouldn't impact our goals, which should still be, we want to reduce animal suffering as much as possible, as fast as possible. That's what I would say. But it does change our strategy. And while some might argue that, but it doesn't change the truth, I've heard this sort of argument. This is where the anti-realist tendencies in me affect my opinion here, because I don't think there is a truth of the matter in terms of what's permissible and what's not. So for example, in the case when we set an age of majority, right? Like when, 18, this is sort of arbitrary, but we set there because, it's safe. We define conventions, and I think we should define conventions with a practical goals in mind. So when we define, should we treat eating meat as impermissible, as something that, what does that even mean? Like, do you treat meat eaters as the same moral monsters that you would treat, I don't know, somebody who's abusing other people or murdering? Or...
This is one of the most difficult things about living in a society that has social norms that I think are foundationally wrong. So on the one hand, this is one of the weird things about my own journey to becoming vegan and, adopting this sentientist idea, is on the one hand, there's this enormous psychological benefit of freeing yourself from cognitive dissonance, at least some of it, and from bringing your actions more in line with, the theory of your ethics. And that can feel very freeing and, a joy. The flip side of that, because frankly, I before I went, went vegetarian maybe 25, 30 years ago, and then vegan maybe 6 or 7. I guess I was a classic case study of someone who agreed with, causing animal suffering is a bad thing to do, let's try not to do it, and causing death and exploitation is a bad thing to do, let's try not to do it. But I used the full suite of human cognitive tools to try to get around actually making the change myself. And the tools include, obviously, dominant social norms, which have taught all of us from birth that it's completely normal to buy from an industry that harms and kills billions of sentient beings for our transient pleasure, right? So that's one big thing. It's just normal. That was the end of the Melody Joy thing you mentioned before. I also used avoidance was probably my main tactic. I just avoided thinking about the topic. I just didn't want to engage with it because I sort of sensed where it would lead me. If I wanted to be consistent and coherent, I'd sense where it would lead me. I also, and this is one of the interesting things in the sentientism idea about the epistemology and the ethics and how they can feed off each other, because I had an ethical conclusion I wanted to maintain, which is that I'm a good person, we are good people, therefore the things we do must be good, therefore animal agriculture must be okay. That warped my epistemology such that I held the belief that, animal agriculture could be humane and sustainable and the animals are well looked after and they're killed painlessly. And these were basically completely factually inaccurate. But I maintained these broken epistemological views in support of my ethics. So I went through that whole pattern. And like I say, switching helped free me from that. And it was a wonderful thing and a joy and something I'll never go back from. But the flip side, and I'm going on too long, the flip side is difficult because I genuinely don't think there is a substantive moral difference between purchasing a product that is made from the flesh of a sentient being and arguably killing that sentient being yourself. So I've come to see a much lower significance in those two, and the difference between those two actions, where a society at large sees a radical difference in those two actions. So it's as if the outsourcing of an act obviates you of any responsibility. It's the distribution of responsibility problem, where the person paying for the system says, well, I'm not causing the harm myself, so it's not my fault. And the system says, well, we're causing the harm, but we're being paid to do it, so it's not really our fault either. And we know what distribution of responsibility can do, again, in intra-human ethics. So it seems, analogous to that topic. But what it does mean is that I have to live in this world, with many of my friends and family. They're the normal ones. Yeah. And I do think that the things they are doing are, you know, awful, awful harms. Mm-hmm. And that itself is a psychological challenge, right? Because as with anyone who's fighting in the early stages of a social justice movement, you can feel a little bit crazy, right? Because you're very confident based on your ethics that you've thought through mm-hmm. that you're right, but you're living in a world where almost everybody is indoctrinated to think you're wrong. And I think there are parallels between this, you know, veganism as a social justice movement and many of the other social justice movements we're still working on within humanity. You can, as you read the works of those people who are at the cutting edges of social justice movements, I feel deep affinity for the frustration they felt because they could see something clearly and the rest of society still had the blinkers on. So yeah, it feels like that. It's tough.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I'll share a bit about my experience also there, because I think I'm also in an unusual position. I haven't met many people, although lately I have met more people who are in sort of this reducitarian position. And in effective altruism circles, people seem to be very also nuanced and not very black and white about veganism. Although there are also the abolitionist vegans within EA. I know you talked to somebody recently who was arguing something related to that.
Drew McMahon. Yeah.
I didn't get to listen to that yet, but it's on my list. But I think at the end of the day, the way I approach this, very pragmatic. But yeah, coming back to my experience, it's interesting because while you mentioned that, but it's so easy, right? And you have to confront these other people eating meat. For me, the difficulty is not so much about feeling indignation. It's more about temptation. You know, like the more I see people eating meat, it's like, I'm making all this effort like to skip meat. So I've been like for 2 weeks, I haven't eaten meat and nobody cares. And I just see them eating meat and I just want a piece of it, you know?
Yeah.
And this is a big challenge. And it's interesting because, you know, in the beginning when I went through a period, I mean, basically my whole life, I mean, I'm from Brazil and I was eating meat all the time. You know, I have all you can eat steak houses and stuff like that. And I never really questioned it. But I mean, quite early on, let's say in high school, I started thinking about the philosophy, ethics and things like that. And the issue of animal welfare came to my mind, and in the justification in my head was always this, like, look, I'm just a consumer, I'm not killing any animals, it is their responsibility to provide these to me in an ethical way, and if they're not doing it ethically, then yes, sure, we should go to the streets and fight, like demand more ethical standards. But then I just kind of assumed that it can't be that bad, you know, that whatever footage they have in these vegan documentaries cherry-picked from some place with terrible like animal welfare or legislation. But actually, the more I started reading into it, the more I realized that, man, this is just not the case. It's like, yeah, it's a shit show everywhere. You know, even the most developed countries, it's insane. And then I started realizing that, okay, I mean, it's so unrealistic for me to expect that this will become an ethical industry on its own that I just can't pretend that I have no impact, that I'm not playing a part into this, at least to some degree. And then I tried to be vegetarian first. And even that, I mean, I was trying to, I never went fully, okay, I'll try to be vegan right away. I was like, okay, I'll try to be vegetarian, vegan when I can. And that was so hard. And I mean, sure, it's also many factors might come in here. Culture, maybe my biology, I don't know. Maybe I really do have some degree of predisposition. Maybe I have very low willpower. I do actually. I mean, I don't really go to the gym, you know, like whenever I try, I just very easily like just ignore my subscription and just stop going. Or I eat bad food in general, like just too many French fries, even if it's vegan, it doesn't matter. Like I am very bad at resisting these temptations. So there's also that, but also the cultural element. And it's interesting, like for me, when I think about what should I do about this? Should I just, what I did is like I gave up and I settled for some reducitarianism, in which I'm basically, not very ambitious at all. I eat meat 3 times per week and that's it. And other than that, I try to be as vegan as possible, yeah, but that's the extent of my commitment. And the fact that I see everybody else acting in a different way is, yeah, it makes me tempted. And now, at least now that I found basically this balance of 3 days that is good enough for me. But it makes me wonder, like the fact that other people are trying even less than me, like, it just makes me feel like the vegan movement is a movement that is kind of it ends up being very elitist in this, in the sense that it filters out most of the population. Like, even if we assume, you know, for the sake of the argument, that, you know, there is a distribution of how much people crave meat biologically. If you define veganism in a very strict sense, then basically you're filtering out most of the population and you're attracting the people who have a lower level of desire, of craving for meat. And it already happened. I mean, I've met people who had lactose intolerance and then they became vegans like that, or people who never liked meat so much and also they become vegans like this. So it's like, it's easy for them, but for people like me, it's just really hard. And then what could I do? Like, either I settle for something like this, which I did, or what? I go to therapy. I often imagine myself going to a psychiatrist and saying, I have a problem. I just can't stop eating meat. Like, it's so surreal. And in Romania, where I live right now, like in Bucharest, I mean, I think it would be hard to even to find a vegan psychiatrist in the first place. Like, it's so surreal that I could approach this problem like this, trying to, like, it's a problem with me. It's so surreal that I can't really take this seriously for very long, you know? Like, very quickly, it's just a societal, it's a systemic problem. I mean, it's so absurd to focus on myself to this extent that, yeah. It makes me a bit hopeless, perhaps. I don't know.
No, I can understand. And it's fascinating because I think in a different world, and maybe in, you know, 10, 15, 20 years time, I could absolutely see you being vegan because, you know, if the alternative products are, you know, good enough and available in Romania and meet your craving needs, if the social norms have shifted, if society has shifted, you know, your ethics are already there. Like you see this as a serious issue. And I think that is a dynamic that will change. As the systems change, it will just become easier and easier for individuals to move in that direction too. So I do have that appreciation for the challenges individuals face and the context people are in, and it's easier for some people and harder for others, and people's psychological makeups are different. I guess my primary concern, and I do think that reducing is better than not reducing. I mean, it's sort of obvious, right? You know, and again, you could take that into a intra-human situation where if you were causing harm to other humans and then you started causing less harm, but you were still causing some, that would be an improvement.
Yeah.
But the thing I'm really keen to avoid, and I do see this come through sometimes in the reducitarian debate, or in people saying, look, veganism is too strict and maybe we need to, you know, be more flexible in the definition of it, is that improving is better than not improving, but it's important not to use the argument for reducing against the argument to abolish.
And
the reason why it's important to avoid that is because, again, we need to think of the victims. Right. So if we were imagining ourselves as the victims and we saw people reducing their consumption of us, we'd say, yes, that is good. But we would also say, please don't stop there. Please end it all. Right? Please end it all. Yeah. And in a way, that's why I think it is important to maintain a stance that isn't pretending to be pure, isn't pretending to be perfect, but does have that victim, that consideration of the victim in mind, that drives us towards an end state where then ultimately there is no suffering, exploitation and death.
Yeah.
And I think that it's important to recognize that these are big systemic changes that we need to make. And you can think about that in terms of corporate changes. You can think about that in terms of government policies and subsidies. You can think about that in terms of social indoctrination and education patterns and things like in the US, you know, the 4-H thing, which trained kids to look after animals and then have them killed, right? So there's an entire wave of sort of structural change we do need to drive. But I think there's two points I'd make about the individual choices. One is those individual choices ultimately can help drive the systemic changes. And if we see a system that is intrinsically and deliberately at its core about causing suffering and death, then I think, you know, boycotting that system and refusing to fund it is a good way of driving the systemic change we need. But it's almost independent from the individual choice we take about what we do as an individual. And in a sense, I'm less interested in, you know, auditing people's personal choices. You know, and I try to be sympathetic because I look back at who I was and the choices I made, and I look at my choices I make now, and I know they're not perfect either. So I have that sympathy, but that sympathy and that flexibility and that understanding doesn't change my stance about whether it's right or wrong to pay for a sentient being to be harmed and killed because I enjoy the taste of its flesh, or because I want the social compliance of feeling normal in my society. Yeah. So I don't know if I want to retain the ethical clarity while respecting the psychological, social, and systemic complexity of the problem we're trying to solve. Yeah. Right. But I just don't want the two to infect each other. And I do sometimes see people explicitly arguing for reduction by attacking abolition. And I'm like, well, but the ultimate point of the reduction is to get towards abolition, right? That we want to end the suffering and the exploitation.
Yeah, in my case, for sure, this is still the goal. The goal is to end all animal suffering one day, if possible, even wild animal suffering, although that's going to take for sure longer.
And that might be I don't know if you want to get onto that tangent, but in a way, that's one of the limitations of veganism, right? Because you could argue that veganism is, you know, I said veganism isn't about humans, right? It's about... you know, preventing harm to non-human sentient beings. But in a way, veganism is quite about humans because it's only trying to reduce human-caused harm. Yeah. Right? It's really just about avoiding causing harm to others. Mm-hmm. But veganism itself doesn't say anything about, you know, the suffering of animals in the wild or the suffering of animals that isn't caused by humans. It leaves that open. Whereas I think a sentientist stance explicitly says that, you know, sentient beings warrant our moral consideration whether they're harmed by humans or not. So so it's an interesting tangent there, but you'd have some very interesting discussions with vegans, because some vegans are absolutely determined that we should end human harms, but are so nervous about human hubris in the way we engage with nature that they absolutely don't want us to, you know, even help wild animals at any serious scale. So.
Yeah, I find it's a very interesting position. Yeah, it's hard for me a bit to. To have them both in my head. One topic that, I mean, we kept coming back to, and it made me think of virtue ethics, is that it seems to, I mean, I'm trying to understand also our disagreement, and it seems that you agree that, I guess I agree with you if I understand you correctly, in that I see your, whenever I bring up nuance that we shouldn't be so black and white, you're like, yes, sure, but also it's very easy to abuse this argument to sort of... there are no rules anymore, and you kind of justify everything. And I agree with that to some extent. So basically, I mean, there's this distinction in utilitarianism that I find very important of some people call naive versus sophisticated utilitarianism, or single-level utilitarianism, multi-level utilitarianism. Basically, it has to do with rules. You know, I used to call myself a rule utilitarian because I consider that, you know, for sure, there are certain rules that we shouldn't respect. For example, the classic example would be the surgeon scenario, right? The transplant problem. So there's a doctor has 5 patients and they all need a different organ. And then somebody comes, a healthy guy comes for the checkup, and they could kill them and save the 5 patients. And most people say, wait, this doesn't sound right. And it's often considered an argument against utilitarianism, because the argument is that, well, according to utilitarianism, this is what the implication, right? You should save more people, minimize suffering. So instead of 5 people dying, 5 times more suffering, and just get 1 person. But it fails to consider, I mean, the multi-level utilitarian would argue against this, this attack by saying that, you're not considering the second order repercussions of this policy. You know, like if we agree as a society that it's okay, it can have many repercussions. There will be second order consequences that we're not considering. So,
and third, fourth, people, fifth, nth order.
Yeah. Exactly. Like people will start fearing the health system. People will, start to avoid certain hospitals. There will be implications that are dangerous. People will be afraid. People will try to leave. But on the other hand, if I see, for example, hypothetically, if I imagine that there is a country where this is the law, and it's a stable country, it's a stable society, and they just happen to have this law, it's a cultural difference, you know, that every now and then if the doctor thinks that they can kill a person, they do it very strategically. And they, let's say they have guidelines on how to make sure that they don't make mistakes, to minimize mistakes. And people just accept that, you know. I couldn't really disagree. And what I wanted to bring up about virtue ethics is that, yeah, this basically multi-level utilitarianism agrees with the importance of rules. So in that sense, I agree with you that, you know, it's too easy to say, I will ignore this rule and do my own thing. This is very dangerous because also, yeah, there's a lot of hubris there. People can become very epistemically irresponsible, are very confident of their own ability to judge the first order, second, third, nth order implications of their actions. And then, so basically, I would say it's just more responsible, like, and more, yeah, rational to say, to delegate and say, look, we don't, maybe breaking this rule in this case will be better in the end. But because we don't know that, it's too risky. It's safer. Let's play safer. Let's all agree together on a set of rules. In this way, we believe that we'll maximize well-being and minimize suffering. But every now and then, yes, there might be situations in which you want to break a rule to accommodate a situation that you didn't think of before. And it still happens today, you know, like when even, I don't know, for example, the tolerance of cannabis and in some countries, how they simply, the police started to say, you know what, you're just a joint and it's still on the law that we shouldn't do it. It's still on the law that they should, you know, get a criminal record, but it just stopped happening. Like it's just the police, there was a shift in culture. And I think it's important to have this flexibility, but I agree with you that you can also go to another extreme when you don't respect anything anymore. And that's where I think virtue ethics is interesting because like Aristotle said, like virtue is the mean between two extremes. So I guess there is such a thing as being too strict about rules, but there's also such a thing as being too lax about rules. So basically, what seems to me is that where our disagreement might be is where exactly to put this dial.
Yeah. Like
I am maybe leaning more towards putting on the more flexible side, while you're leaning more to put it on a more strict side.
Yeah. Does that make sense? I think it might be. And I think that's that potentially is partly driven by how seriously we consider these other beings as moral patients. Because I think if you were talking about an intrahuman ethics stance, you would probably be a bit more strict too. And I'm sort of just suggesting we apply that strictness to non-human sentient beings as well. Your comment about virtue ethics is interesting because that's probably one of the things that's happened to me as I've been working on this sentientism project over time is I've probably become a bit more pluralistic. So in a sense, anything that focuses on sentience you could argue is a bit consequentialist because, you know, an impact on the sentient experience of a being is a consequence, right? And that's ultimately what I care about. So I'm quite comfortable with consequentialism more broadly, but it's been fascinating to see how different ethical theories can still implement this really common moral scope baseline. So a virtue ethics stance, which is normally anthropocentric, doesn't need much tweaking to say, well, if kindness is a virtue, shouldn't we express kindness for all beings that can be subjects of harm, that are sentient? So a virtue ethics that applies kindness to sentient beings is quite straightforward. You know, the deontological approach, people like Christine Korsgaard have done great work of saying, look, it's not just human beings that are ends in themselves. It's all sentient beings that are ends in themselves. There's a feminist care ethic, clearly, which you know, starts out from an anthropocentric position, thinking about how we care about each other and how those roles of care and those relations of care are important. But again, it's trivially easy to extend that obligation to care to all sentient beings. Utilitarianism is fascinating because on the one hand, many of the modern thinkers about animal ethics who obviously picked up ancient deep themes about ahimsa and other ways of caring about non-human animal ethics, but many of the modern philosophers that are most thought of, whether it's Bentham or Singer and others, Richard Rider, you know, took quite a utilitarian approach to thinking about, the value of suffering, the value of flourishing as being core to what utility is. But I guess part of my challenge with some interpretations of utilitarianism, and you hinted at these, is that some versions of utilitarianism come to think of sentient beings as more just containers of what matters rather than beings that matter in their own right. And that can lead you into ideas of, you know, can we offset suffering, or do we aggregate suffering, or we treat it in a more mathematical way? Mm-hmm. And my challenge to that, and I think many people's challenge to those modes of utilitarianism, is that you've stepped away from the being themselves, the sentient being themselves, mm-hmm. you and me and our perspective and how that matters. So while from a, you know, sort of an uber-arching top-down view, you can take decisions about aggregate levels of suffering, and, you know, mm-hmm. you might see that as a valid means of deciding on a sensible policy. My suffering cannot be offset. Right, somebody else might look at my suffering and say, well, I've offset it with the pleasure of somebody else. But my suffering remains. Right? My suffering as a sentient being, that remains. And my interests remain. You know, no being feels the aggregate suffering. No being feels the offset suffering. As a sentient being, I experience these things. And that's the root of the morality. And I think that, I think, can still be consistent with some versions of utilitarianism. But it's also that centering on the sentient being as the moral patient that matters, not just the sort of abstract experiences they're having. It's the fact that they are a being having those experiences that matters. And maybe that's what drives partly, you know, the fact I take a slightly, you know, purer or slightly sharper approach to you.
I think so, because it does seem that I do tend a lot more to have this aggregate suffering type of approach to things. I do actually, the way you phrased it, that seeing like people or animals as a container for the things that matter, which is their experience, I actually tend to agree with that. But yeah, I am aware of the counterintuitive implications of my views, because it leads to all sorts of things like antinatalism or even promortalism, or the idea that it's turning off the universe, eliminating all life, that would be okay because no more suffering.
Yeah, so, and do you get my point that, you know, no, someone might offset your suffering at a policy level, mm-hmm. but you will still be suffering, and your suffering would still matter, right? I mean, there's just no getting around that.
Of course, that ideally we want to reduce all the suffering, but I mean, utilitarianism confronts the reality that we cannot do what's ideal.
Yeah.
In most of situations, we are constrained by a brutal reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
About our feelings.
Yeah, and then absolutely. Nature is amoral.
Yeah, exactly. I see we've gone a bit over an hour. Just to go over a bit an overview of how we did in terms of the script and how much we stick with what's left out. I mean, we didn't talk much about how confident we were about our views before and after. This is one of the things that I wanted to do. But I guess it makes sense, because a lot of our conversation ended up being about understanding really where exactly we disagree. So it's not that it was hard to come up with a number in terms of our confidence. But I did think of a question that kind of brings us back to this in some degree. Let's say, for example, that, national vegan association in one country, let's say collaborating with another country, say, let's try different approaches, you know, have the countries do a much more nuanced approach in which they stop promoting veganism as a moral baseline. They still encourage people to go all the way. And it's at all times, they keep it clear that this is the ultimate goal, to reduce the suffering completely. But they are much more, let's say, friendly in their message and much more flexible and less black and white about rules. And another group that decides to be more abolitionistic. And let's say that the result of this experiment is that in every place, in most places where they had the more nuanced approach, there was actual reduction of meat consumption and changes in perception of veganism. Veganism became more accepted and it actually had a better impact. Would that change your mind about where to put that dial in terms of how strict and how flexible we should be?
What I care about is the outcome, is ultimately mm-hmm. the consequences. So if there's an approach that is more productive, I'd support mm-hmm. that approach. But I think what's important is that we don't lose the ethical clarity in that approach, in that mm-hmm. stance.
Okay.
So and I do see that risk looming large, because one thing us humans are really good at is finding post-rationalizations for us not changing. So on the one hand, there are some people, and I think you're probably in this camp, who your reducitarianism is driven by a you know, there is a genuine ethical concern, and you recognize, you know, there are challenges and we may disagree about that, but there is a genuine ethical concern that is driving you there. And your end goal is the same as mine, which is ultimately an abolition of, you know, animal farming, for example, a system that is explicitly exploitative and harmful. So that's one approach. There are others who will argue for an incremental approach or an animal welfare approach or a humane farming approach or a reducitarian approach with a different end goal. And the different end goal is basically carry on pretty much as we are, but with a few tweaks. Mm-hmm. And there I have a fundamental disagreement, because again, if you imagine that happening in an intrahuman start situation, and there have been many through history, right? There have been people who've said, here is a system and it is intrinsically terrible and we need to work to end it. And there are others who just said, let's just do it a little bit more nicely. And so that's, so I do have a concern that if we take a reducitarian or an incremental or a welfarist tactic, if those things are productive, fine, but we have to have the ethical clarity that keeps the voice and the values and the interests and the needs of the victims present in the discussion. Otherwise, there's a real risk that we will just end up in some sort of ethics washing horrific state where we've just convinced ourselves that we don't really need to change much. And you can see that you made a really important point earlier on, which I see reflected in the debate today, where it's become more and more common for people to say, you know, I'm against factory farming. You know, there are large scale surveys, and even in the public discourse, it's very, very common, not just vegans, right? But in some of the surveys, almost a majority of people would say, I'm against factory farming, right?
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, if 46% of people say they're against factory farming, that's odd, because in the US, 99% of products come from factory farming, and globally, 90% do. So there's clearly a dissonance there, but at least there's a latent ethics that you could say, well, this is great, right? We can at least build on that, because if we can make it easier for people to transition away, then we're systemically going to move in the right direction. But part of the reason people focus on factory farming, sometimes it's genuinely because factory farming is the most egregious part of the problem. It's the biggest part of the problem, and it causes the most suffering. So some people are genuinely focusing on factory farming as a tactic because it's the worst part of the problem. Other people like to focus on factory farming because if you focus on factory farming, it opens up the implication that there are other types of animal farming that are ethically acceptable and sustainable. So you'll see this in the regenerative animal agriculture movement. You'll see this in the idea that there are such things as humane farms or local farms or non-factory farmed. But again, epistemologically, and you mentioned this earlier on, right, because you went through this journey of saying, look, maybe there's a nice way of animal farming, and you realize there just isn't, because when you take the perspective of the animals themselves,
I would still think that there might be all
the worst parts of factory farming are standard practices in non-factory farming, whether it's the family separation, the mutilation, the artificial insemination, and ultimately the slaughter, right? They end up in the same slaughterhouses. So again, I'm very open-minded about incremental approaches and reducitarian approaches and different tactics, because we have to recognize the inertia of systems and human psychology and sociology. Completely agree, but we cannot lose that ethical clarity and that voice of the victims in what we're trying to do.
Yeah. My stance now, I guess, in terms of what's possible in terms of ethical farming, I guess it's possible in principle, and perhaps I think it's more possible than you think, because I only care about sentience, I am okay with painlessly killing an animal for consumption. But then again, I think it's, in practice, is so hard and so complicated to do this in a clean, ethical way. I mean, without separating a families, how are you going to do it? There are too many aspects during the life of an animal that implies suffering.
And but I think also that's another really interesting and common view that comes through some forms of utilitarianism, which is this idea that painless killing is not a harm. And one, I think you're absolutely right, right? That has absolutely nothing to do with animal farming and fishing today, because there is no euthanasia, right? It just doesn't happen. Secondly, to your earlier point, it ignores the second order effects on the group and the family and the other beings around them. And interestingly, even from a utilitarian perspective, killing somebody ends their potential for positive future experiences. So even from a utilitarian perspective, I've never quite understood this thing. But the other interesting thought experiment is, does that apply to humans? You know, there's the classic Thanos snap, or the, in the UK, we had an instance where there was someone who's now in prison for life for murder because they killed, painlessly killed hundreds of elderly people by drugging them.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so from your stance, that person should not be in prison. They've done no wrong.
No, I mean, again, for the same, for pragmatic reasons, because I considered the second order implications of things, yeah, I think this should still be illegal. But in terms of, do I think they did something very bad? I wouldn't say so.
Yeah. So that's one area where we do disagree, because I think, again, if we put all the philosophy to one side, right, I don't want to be killed painlessly in my sleep tonight.
Well, so I find this, I can't even say, if you ask me, if I am neutral about this. The thing is, the fact of the matter is, if I am killed painlessly in my sleep, I won't know, I won't care.
That's true.
And I won't ever suffer again. So in some way.
That's true. That's true.
It's very safe. It's a safe
way. Well, I hope it doesn't happen to you. I hope it doesn't happen
to you. Yeah, me too, I guess, at some level.
At least
I want to publish this conversation first.
And we should extend that to, you know, we should extend that consideration to all other sentient beings, because most of them don't want to die either, whether it's painless or not. They really don't. I mean, and again, we've evolved to want to continue living, mostly.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think moral consideration includes, I think a basic moral consideration means we need to recognize that most sentient beings have an interest in continuing to live. So let's let them do it.
Yeah, that's a difficult one.
I think it's easy.
I can imagine a whole conversation about this, because I'm very undecided about my views there. But another thing that I thought about, I guess, I agree with you that, having this, if we promoting this, you know, green, sustainable agriculture, and like, it's kind of ignoring the really big problem there. Like the elephant in the room is like, it's animals who still have to suffer, will still have to be castrated. Like, all these things will still happen.
Yeah. And they're killed when they reach adulthood. They're killed when they reach adulthood or when they stop producing.
Yeah. But I guess because maybe I'm the techno-optimist in me makes me, I don't even pay attention to these things, because with the progress that I see in my cellular agriculture, I think this argument will be weaker and weaker, you know, like more and more it's going to become clear that we will move on to a cellular agriculture type of system. And then it won't even be necessary anymore to say, no, we can do farming in a in a humane way. It will become less relevant, I think. But it's true that it's still relevant today.
Well, I think this is another point we have in common. We both envisage a vegan sentientist world, even if we differ about how to get there.
Cool. Well, it's been almost 20 minutes, more than 1 hour at this point. So we could end here. Do you have anything else to say to the others, of if you can tell people where to find more about you or about sentientism?
Yeah, of course. So I guess two closing thoughts. One is, I think it's really important to combine a good quality epistemology, this commitment to evidence and reason, and our compassion for all sentient beings, because either by itself isn't enough. You know, if we're compassionate for all sentient beings, but we're wrong about reality, we can make terrible mistakes. And if we have an accurate understanding of reality, but we just don't care about valid moral patience, terrible things can happen. So that's why sentientism includes, you know, both sides, evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. I guess my appeal to people in your audience, who I'm imagining will be quite sympathetic to the naturalistic side already, and maybe secular humanism and atheism, is that in the same way as we've extended our moral scope within humanity, that's not just a generous act of, you know, caring about others, although that's the core of it, it's also been good for those doing the extending too. And I think this is another classic situation where it may feel culturally or socially or practically challenging, but extending our moral consideration out, not just to companion sentient beings, which we already do, and selective wildlife, but to farmed animals and animals in labs and even wild animals, I think that's going to be great for humans too, both because it enables us to move to a more consistent, coherent ethic that I think will be good for our intra-human ethics. I think it will also set a better stance for how we think about artificial intelligence ethics, a field that is moving quite quickly now. I would suggest that if our artificial intelligences learn from humans about how to treat less powerful sentient beings, we're in a lot of trouble in 10, 15 years. So there's another reason for us to, you know, be more generous in our moral scope. But also just very practically, and one of the things we haven't talked about here, is the the catastrophic waste of animal agriculture because of feed conversion ratios, because you need to put, you know, on average 10 times more inputs, edible plants, through an animal to get, you know, 1/10 out, means that there are even completely selfish anthropocentric reasons to shift to a, ultimately to a vegan world and a plant-based food system. It would save 75% of our agricultural land. It would slash our emissions of CH4 and NO2. It would slash pollution, air pollution and water pollution. It would cut zoonotic disease. So, you know, even if we don't care about non-human animals, I think there's an overwhelming, you know, human-centric reason to shift our food and agricultural and plant and systems towards plants too. So the final thing I'd say is, yeah, if you're interested in this sort of sentientism worldview, we're pretty much everywhere. So we have friendly online forums that are open to anyone interested, not just sentientists, that you can come and join. We have our own YouTube and podcast that I'd love people's feedback on. But yeah, I just love to continue the conversation, see what people think of the worldview and its implications. And although we've talked here about its implications for veganism and our food systems, it has deep implications for intrahuman ethics as well. And you can run this sentientist idea through politics, law, economics, democracy. There's some fascinating implications for intrahuman ethics too.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Jamie. Yeah, for being my first guest in this experiment. Yeah. And yeah, keep in touch.
I will do. It's been an honor. Thanks. I look forward to hearing what people think.
So thank you for listening to the first Ghostless Machine dialogue. I hope you enjoyed it. As I'm sure you noticed, I stuttered a lot and I was overall way less articulate than Jamie, but in my defense, I'm not a native English speaker, and this is literally the first podcast I've ever hosted, so I hope you'll be forgiving enough to give me a second chance and listen to my next conversation. Hopefully, as I gain experience, and it should become less and less painful to hear me speak. Again, if you like this kind of content, don't hesitate to like this video, share it with your friends, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube and on your favorite podcast platform. And if you want to learn more about how you can help the channel, you can find all the information on ghostlessmachine.com.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?